So the last 3 weeks ago, I guess, what we did was the mitzvot in Shlach after the Meraglim, and we showed how the mitzvot in Shlach are playing off different themes that emerged during the Meraglim. But the most famous of the mitzvot that's at the end of Parshas Shlach is the mitzvah of tzitzis. And that seems to be the one that most directly responds to the Meraglim. And that's what I want to explore today. And it all really hangs on one word. The Meraglim, even though we call them the Meraglim, based on when they appear in Dvarim, the truth is that in the story of the Meraglim itself, that word is really not used. They're not called Meraglim spies, they're called Tarim. Tourists, essentially, surveyors of the land. And that word appears, it's sort of a rare word. It comes up very often. It comes very often in this story, in the story of the Meraglim, but otherwise it doesn't come up so much. But where it does come up is in number one, right? This is the end of the third parak, the third chapter of Kriya Shema, the parsha of Tzitzis, where we find v'hayalachem letzitzit uritem otoz chartem et kol mitzvot adonai vasitem otam lo taturu achar levavchem acharei neichem asher atem zonim achareihem. So we say these tzitzit will be for you, and you'll see them, and you'll remember the mitzvot of God. And you won't, velo taturu, right? You won't be led astray after your hearts and after your eyes, which you are being led astray after. So that you'll remember and you'll keep the mitzvot, and you'll be holy to God. And I am God who took you out of Egypt to be your God. And that word, and this has led many to suggest that tzitzit, more than any of the other mitzvot, sort of in this unit, are meant to be the corrective to the story of the spies. Because right, the midrash plays up and it says, what does it mean that the, lo taturu, right, don't be led astray? It's a weird word. Again, it's the same root as, right, as latur, as to, it's two pages. It's two pages, two pages, two pages. Here. So if you look in the Midrash Tanchuma, the Tanchuma says, well, what it means is, Halev v'heinayim hein sirsurin laguf, shehein mezanin emaznim et haguf. The heart and the eyes are the agents of the body, and they leave the body astray. But Rashi, when he is paraphrasing the Midrash, changes one word. And he says, Kumo mitura aretz, halev v'hainayim hem miraglim laguf. Right? The eyes and the heart are the spies for the body. Right? And Rashi is clearly changing the word to highlight the point of the Pesuk and the point of the Midrash. That after we see the danger of the Meraglim, of people being led astray, being caught up in their passions, right, in their fear, right? They go, they spy, and all the things we've sort of talked about, that the spies go out, and they should have simply gone to confirm that the land was good, because God had already promised that it was good, God had assured them that they could conquer it, but instead they go judgmentally, and they say that we don't trust God's assessment of the good, and instead we're going to rebel against Him, and we're going to want to go back to Egypt, right? And then they're led into they're slowly led into this frenzied passion, right? They start by saying, "Well, it's good, but the people are strong," and then the next time they're strong, and we can't do it, and we're going to die, and we should go back to Egypt, right? Let's actually do it, right? It would be better to die in Egypt, and then let's actually go back to Egypt, right? They're caught up in their emotion. It starts as an assessment of the situation that it's difficult, but then as they allow their fear to sink in, they're slowly worked up into this frenzy, right? And it causes them to throw everything away, right? Everything that God gave them, they throw away. That's sort of at the macro level. But what the Midrash picks up on is that even if we don't do this at the level of the Meraglim, we all have this, right? That we know what's right, but then we have our own spies, right? Halev einayim. We have our eyes and our hearts that they see things, and then they begin to desire it, right? Or as Rashi says it elsewhere, right? Halev roa einayim roim vehalev chomed, right? Vaguf oset. Right, the eyes see, the heart desires, and then the body does. Right, we're also in the exact same way. Right, we start simply by seeing it, assessing it, seeing something that we might want to do, but then we allow it to sink in, and our heart desires it, even though we know it's wrong. And then agufosa, and then right, we end up doing it. So tzitzis is sort of the mitzvah of tzitzis. That warning, don't be led astray again by your eyes and then your heart to the point where you would actually act on it, is warning us that the same phenomenon, that same slippery slope that happened by the Meraglim, where first they saw it and then they allowed their emotions to take charge, and then they actually said, "Nitna roshvit and shuvah mitzrayim," let's actually do it. Let's actually give up on everything that's happened and just go back to Egypt and physically turn back the clock. Right? That's the situation we're always in. And therefore, God gives a mitzvah of tzitzit to remind us to avoid that situation. And once you have that, you realize that the themes and the words that come up in the tzitzit parsha, it's not just the word latur, but it comes out. Throughout, similar words happen throughout the Meraglim story. So I just gave you the Meraglim story again, but this time with everything underlined, right? And you can see just how many times the word latur comes up, right? It comes up in Pasuk Bet, Shlach Lecha and Hashem V'yatur, Eretz Kenaan, in Tet Zayin, it's Eilu Shmor Hashem Asher Shalach Moshe Latur, et Haaretz, in Yud Zayin, V'yishlach Otam Moshe Latur, et Eretz Kenaan, in Chav Hei, it's V'yashuvu Mitur Haaretz, right? Over and over, they are the Tarim. But their problem is, and right, if you remember back in the parsha of tzitzit, the pasuk tells you, if you look at the tzitzit and you see them, then you will remember the mitzvot of God. That sight problem, right, the ability to see things, and that be the beginning of a downward slope rather than the way you remember God, is also the theme of the Meraglim. And those are the words I underlined in 4, right? Uritem et aretz mahi, you'll see the land. Right, you'll see it, which is supposed to be a good thing, but by the time you get to Chavchet, and this is right the end of it, just follow the underlines. Right? It's Efes ki az ha'am ha'yoshev ba'aretz va'arim b'tzorok dolot ma'od v'gam yilidei ha'anak ra'inu sham. Right? We see the giants, and then in Lamed Gimel, v'sham ra'inu et ha'nefilim. We saw the giants, b'nei ha'anak v'nefilim, v'nehi v'einenu k'chagavim v'cheneinu v'einahem. And then this emphasis on the eyes, right? That we were... they saw us as grasshoppers, and that's how we saw ourselves, right? This emphasis on perception and what do you see, and then how does it make it to your heart, right? What does it drive you to do? And in the story of the Meraglim, their fear, their self-perception, because of how they saw the giants and how they saw the land, is what led them to want to go back to Egypt. Right? It's no coincidence that in the tzitzit story, right, God doesn't just say, you'll see the tzitzit and you'll remember God. Generically, he says, in going back to 1, Ani Adonai Eloichem Asher Hotzeit Yedchem Eret Mitzrayim L'chiyot Lachem L'Elohim Ani Adonai Eloichem. It'll remind you that I took you out of Egypt. Right? He's setting up a mitzvah that is going to remind them not to fall into the trap. And you see it in 5. Right? This is the theme, the other theme of Meraglim. Lumatnu Beretz Mitzrayim, if only we died in Egypt. And then, as we noted, that spirals out of control. Right? First it's idealizing Egypt. And then it's idealizing dying in Egypt. And then it's Pasuk Gimel, V'lam Adonai mevi otanu el aretz hazot l'nepo b'cherem nashenu v'tavinu yelavaz halov tov lanu shuv mitzrayimah. Why are we being brought here to die? It would be better to go back to Egypt. V'yomru ish el achiv, nitna rosh, v'nashuv mitzrayimah. Let's go back to Egypt. And then, what is God's punishment? Right? God punishes them and says, because you wanted to go back to Egypt, right, and you sinned, as we saw in the Meraglim story, that you saw with what you saw, the way you perceive things, that you complained about, we were grasshoppers in their eyes, and that's how we viewed ourselves. So God's punishment, continuing in 5, after the ellipsis, is, V'amru l'shev aretz azot, shamu ki atah Adonai bekerav am hazeh, asher ayin ba'ayin nir'ah, atah Adonai v'anancha omed aleihem v'amur anan, atah oleich lefneihem yoman v'amur eish laila. God turns back, Moshe turns back to God and says, you can't kill the people. Because if you kill the people, you have a perception problem. Right? Because the people who saw you, ayin ba'ayin, the people who are known for being able to see you, you can't kill. Right? So Moshe says, yeah, maybe they saw the wrong things. They misused their eyes and their perception. But that's not how the world looks at it. The world looks at the Jewish people as those who perceive you. And if you kill them, they'll think it's not because they don't deserve it, but because you aren't capable. Right? Because there's a perception problem. The world perceives the Jews as those who perceive God. Right? You can't escape that fact. God accepts it. He says, you're right, I have a perception problem. I can't kill the Jews because everyone knows that they understand me. But my punishment is, right, he's very careful. He doesn't say that they won't enter the land. He says, Chav Gimel, Im yiru et ha'aretz asher nishbati lavotam, v'chol menatzai lo yiruha. Right? I have a perception problem. No one can see. Right? They looked at the land askance, so I should kill them. But I can't, because then people will look askance at me. So the retribution is they won't see the land. Right? And this sort of puts a different spin on what Hashem says to Moshe. Right? Moshe says, let me into the land. And God says, I won't let you into the land, but I'll let you see it. Right? It's you can't go in the land, but you're not amongst the generation of Meraglim. Right? You will see them. Shama lo ta'avor. But vereita beinech, I will allow you to see it with your eyes, because you're not the Meraglim. You sinned with your own sin, so I'll let you see, I'll let you set your eyes on the land, because you're not them. You sinned, I won't let you in. That's a different story. But the punishment is framed as you won't see the land. Not you won't go in. They obviously won't go in, right? But you won't even get a glimpse of the land. And when you put it together, what you get is that the Meraglim story is the story of people who let their perceptions, right, let their perceptions go crazy. Right? God told them, the land is good, it's okay. When you see the enemies, you see the giants, don't worry about it. Because yes, you're seeing giants. Yes, they are there. But remember, I'm behind you. It's not a question of sight, it's a question of perception. Do you perceive that you are hopeless? You see the giants. I can't change the fact that you see the giants. But do you perceive them as unconquerable enemies? Or do you realize that I'm behind you? And it's the story of people who saw scary things, but then allowed it to process wrong. Right? They allowed it to hit their hearts in a way that was wrong. Instead of saying what Yehoshua and Kalev said, I see it, but I have a different perspective on it. I know that God is behind me. I'm okay. They said, no. The first thing we see, the first way it processes, that's how I feel it. That's how I experience it. I let that control me. I don't control how I perceive things. I allow my first reaction to control how I feel. And God says, okay, well then you can't go into the land, right? If you are going to allow that to drive you crazy, drive you to the point where first you idealize Egypt, even death in Egypt, and then you say, let's actually go back. So God says, forget it. Moshe says to God, okay, but look, there are different perceptions. The Jews may have failed in their ability to perceive the truth, but too bad. The world perceives you and them as tied to each other's, your legacies are tied. If you kill the Jews, they're just going to say, it's because you're too weak. Because they know that the Jews are the ones who saw you ayin ba'ayin. Whose their eyes may have seen wrong here, but they've also seen you. So God says, you're right. But then the punishment will be commensurate. I won't kill them, but I will also never let them set their eyes on the land. Right? If they've sinned with their eyes and that whole trajectory, then that's their punishment. But God doesn't want to leave it there. And God doesn't want to say, okay, that's the end of the story. The Jews sinned with their inability to control themselves, and therefore, I'm just going to turn it back on them. God says, but I have a solution. Because it's not only for bad that we can be led astray by symbols, right? By first glances. It's not just you see the scary things and then you allow that to, right? We're also strengthened by the smallest things, right? We can use it to our advantage, right? The same way a flag, right? A flag, right? People are, right? Planting a flag or ripping down a flag, you know, right, raises the morale of the soldiers or destroys that morale, right? When the army sees that the enemy has gone there and torn down the flag, right, that breaks their morale. There's no particular reason why it should break their morale, right? If they're right behind them and they can put the flag right back up, right, why do they spend so much time trying to plant the flag, pull the flag down? Because we're affected by symbols. So God says, I have a solution. If you're so easy... So I know, as he said, Lo taturu acharei levavchem, acharei einichem, asher atem zonim achareihem. This isn't only a problem in the Meraglim. You do this all the time. You know what's right. You know the truth. You know I took you out of Egypt. You know we have a relationship. But what happens? You know that deep down. But then you see something and you want it. But, you know, to get it, you've got to steal. You've got to cheat. You've got to... Right? You've got to cut corners. You've got to whatever, right? Whether it be monetary crimes or sexual crimes or repetitive, whatever it might be, right? You want to eat that, right? You're not, you know, it's not kosher. You're not sure if it's kosher. Whatever the case may be. You see it, you know shouldn't do it. But you see it, and then you want it, and then you do it. God says, you do this all the time. The same basic approach, right? Happens all the time. But I'm going to reverse it. I have a solution for you. And that is... I'll give you a reverse symbol. I'll give you tzitzis. And now I'll give you something to see. And when you see it, you'll then remember God. Right? And if you can be led astray that quickly, then I can lead you back just as quickly if you're open to it. Okay, do I want to skip to this? Yeah, you know what? Let's skip to this, and then we'll come back to the other sources. Skip to 12, right? Dan Ariely, right, writes about this in his... Dan Ariely, do anyone know Dan Ariely? He's one of the most fun writers in sort of the modern behavioral psychology schools, right? His first four books are a lot of fun, but then his fifth book, which just came out, Dollars and Cents, he actually teamed up with a comedian to write it. Like, he tries to make his reading very accessible. So he, as his name sounds, is Jewish. He's Israeli, right? Originally, he doesn't live in Israel now. He lives in, he's in Duke University. But his books are, right, his first book is Predictably Irrational, one of them is Irrationally Yours. Right? It's, as the titles give away, right? It's about the fact that human beings are irrational and that we shouldn't deny that, right? But that we shouldn't necessarily try to overcome it either by being rational, right? His, you know, behavioral psychologists, their newest contribution to the world is that human beings are irrational, right? You have to deal with that, okay? But... You know, there's a book, it just won the Nobel Prize. The person who wrote it won the Nobel Prize this year, Thaler, right, wrote a book called Nudge. Right? Nudge is a book which takes the insight of behavioral psychology and points out we're irrational, but gives very practical solutions of how to use that irrationality to our own benefit. So, for example, one of the things that he suggested is that people are very lazy, and therefore most people, even if they want to leave money for retirement... won't, even if all they have to do is check a box. Even if, you know, on their contract, they have to check a box that says, I want to leave money, automatically go into my RRSP, they won't do it, right? But they all want it, right? Everyone wants it. Everyone knows it's the right thing to do. They even mean to do it, they just never get around to it. So what Thaler and Sunstein suggest is there's an easy solution. Without taking away anyone's freedom, instead of making it an opt-in, make it an opt-out. Same contract, but it has a box on the bottom that says, if you don't want money to go into your RRSP, check the box. You've maintained people's total freedom, but knowing that people are irrational, you slightly shift the balance so that now, right, what they say is use choice architecture, right? Their point is, whenever you write the document, there has to be a choice at some point, right? You have to either choose to opt in or opt. Why make the choice the one that people will likely do what they don't want to do? That is against their self-interest. It's not like, right, you're helping people do what they already want to do. It's not like anybody doesn't want to save money. They just never get around to checking the box. So just make it an opt out instead of an opt in, and everyone will succeed. Right? And they've tried this. Right? I mean, there was a nudge group. That's what it was called, the nudge group, under Tony Blair, right, in the British government, and Obama also had members of this sort of psychological team helping them make policy, right? They've used policies like this for savings, right? Because it helps all of society, right? Everyone wants you to have money so you don't fall on on welfare. Everybody, it's good for everybody if people save. You want to save, the government wants you to save, society wants you, everyone wants you to save. They've used it for organ donation, right? Because even in countries where they're in favor of organ donation, if it's an opt-in, no one checks the box, right? You'll have societies where 80% want to check the box and 20% do. In Spain, they made it an opt-out, and overnight, they had a 90% right organ donor rate. That's all it takes, the difference between an opt-in and opt-out box. So Dan Ariely, being Jewish, right, and having some experience with the Gemara, notes as follows. So first, I'm going to show you some of his experiments, right? This is one of his favorites. He said, in the experiment, we asked participants to complete a test, told them they'd receive cash for every correct answer, and made sure they knew they had ample room to cheat, right? He wanted to test cheating. This was the goal, to test cheating. Now here's the kicker. Prior to starting, we had half the participants list 10 books off their high school reading list, and the other half to recall the Ten Commandments, a manipulation that turned out to have a marked effect on the results. While many in the first group deceitfully reported a higher number of correct answers, no one in the second group cheated. Right, so here was the experiment. They gave them room to cheat. They had to self-mark. Right? It was basically, right, it was the easiest thing in the world to cheat. All they asked them before, right, there was nothing on the line, really, right? It was just an experiment. But they asked them, remember 10 books. If they remembered 10 random books, they cheated. If they were asked to remember the 10 commandments, they didn't cheat. And, right, I didn't put the whole experiment, but what was amazing about the experiment was that this was true even if they didn't remember the Ten Commandments. It didn't matter. And it didn't matter if they were atheist or religious. It had made no difference. Being asked to think about a well-known code of morality was enough to get people not to cheat. That's all it takes, was a moment. He says, how do we explain the findings? A tempting conclusion to draw would be to equate religiosity with a higher morality. However, this argument doesn't hold, since in a follow-up study with atheist participants, recalling the Ten Commandments had the exact same effect. Rather, what was at play here was the power of a moral reminder. Prime a person to think about ethics right before they have an opportunity to cheat, and they'll avoid immoral behavior. That's all it takes. And they had another experiment. They did the exact same thing, and before they had to take the test, all they did was they signed a statement that says, I commit to adhering by the MIT standard of code of ethics. There is no MIT Code of Ethics. It literally doesn't exist. But by signing that I commit to the Code of Ethics, they also didn't cheat. Right? That's all it took. It took a reminder. Now, based on this, he continues. Right? This is in his book, The Honest Truth About Dishonesty. One professor at Middle Tennessee State University got so fed up with the cheating among his MBA students that he decided to employ a more drastic honor code. Inspired by our Ten Commandments experiment and its effect on honesty, Thomas Tang asked his students to sign an honor code stating that they would not cheat on an exam. The pledge also stated that they would be sorry for the rest of their lives and go to hell if they cheated. The students, who did not necessarily believe in hell or agree what they were getting or agree that they were going there, were outraged. The pledge became very controversial, and perhaps unsurprisingly, League 10 caught a lot of heat for his effort. He eventually had to revert to the old hell-free pledge. Great. Still, I imagine that in short existence, this extreme version of the honor code had quite an effect on the students. I also think the students' outrage indicates how effective this type of pledge can be. The future businessmen and women must have felt that the stakes were very high, or they would have not cared so much. Right? People recognize that if you force them to think about morality, it will be harder for them to cheat. They know that it's true, even if they don't believe in anything you're talking about. Simply making someone think about morality for a moment, we know it affects us. And if you want to be able to cheat, you don't want to be forced to think even for a moment. But then he continues and he writes, the possibility of using religious symbols as a way to increase honesty has not escaped religious scholars. There's a story in the Talmud about a religious man who had become desperate for sex and goes to a prostitute. His religion wouldn't condone this, of course, but at the time he feels that he has more pressing needs. Once alone with the prostitute, he begins to undress. As he takes off his shirt, he sees his tzitzit, an undergarment with four pieces of knotted fringe. Seeing that tzitzit reminds him of the mitzvot, and he quickly turns around and leaves the room without violating his religious standards. Right? And the story he's referring to is 14, where the Gemara says, Ma'aseh ba'adam echad, shaya zahir b'mitzvah tzitzit. Right? There was a man who was very careful about tzitzit. Shamashi zona b'krachei ayam, shenotelet arba meot zuhuvim b'schara. He heard about a prostitute who took 400 gold coins for her payment. He already paid the kavala zman, and he set a time. When the time came, he came and he sat at the door. Her servant, right? This is a very high class. Her maid comes and tells her the man who paid 400 coins is waiting by the door. Amrahi. So he came, so she had seven beds of silver, and then one of gold, and between each one there was a ladder of silver, and the top one was gold, and she was at the top of it, unclothed. And then he went and he was unclothed, and as he gets up, his tzitzit came and hit him on the face, and he went and he sat on the ground. Right. So after the money, the built suspense, up the silver, right, up the silver beds and the silver ladders, right, the tzitzit hit him in the face, and he sits on the floor. But Avinish mitav yashval gabe karga. So she comes down, and Amra la gufa shel romi she'eini manichatcha ad shetomar li mamum ra'ita bi. I won't let you go until you tell me what was wrong with me. Amra la ha'avodah shel ra'iti isha yafa kamoteich. I've never seen anyone as beautiful as you. Ela mitzvah achat sivanu Hashem Elokeinu. God gave us one mitzvah. V'tzitzit shma. It's called tzitzit. Uktiv ba ani Hashem Elokeichem, and it says, "I am God." Shtei pa'amim, ani hu she'atid li parav, ani hu she'atid l'shalem schar. It says, "I am God" twice. One, I am God who rewards, and I am God who punishes. Right? And what Ariely points out is that what the Gemara already understood is that tzitzit isn't that much of a reminder, right? But when people get caught up, right, in passion, sometimes all they need is to be reminded that it's not in line with their own value system. And if they, that breaks the momentum. And all you need to do often, right, and this is Thaler's whole point, it's not that we don't know what to do. It's not that we don't know what's best for us. We do. We just don't check the opt-in box. All you've got to do is reverse it, right, and make us opt out, and we'll never opt out, right? We'll never opt out of something that's good for us, as long as you remind us, as long as you nudge us, right? That's his point. The book is called Nudge for a reason. And there's a reason it won the Nobel Prize, because it's very simple, but figuring out how to take that basic belief that we are irrational, that we are prone to being caught up in emotions, and that we act not against what's right, we act against what we ourselves want to do. And, right? That's the fundamental, right, his fundamental insight. It's not that we're trying to make people do things they don't believe in or that they don't want to do. It's that people don't do what they want to do. They want to save for retirement, but they don't check the box. So all you got to do is change it from opt-in to opt-out, and everyone will save for retirement. That's all it takes, right? And Ariely said, yeah, God was the first one who knew this, right? That the Meraglim get totally caught up in this whole thing, right? It spins out of control very quickly, and God says, I have a solution because you face this every day. And the solution is tzitzit, right? A little reminder. Now, tzitzit is only one example of many, right? Tzitzit, mezuzah, right? We have many others. It's not the only one. It's the one that's placed here in the in this sort of unit of mitzvot. But the reason that halacha plays so much on symbolism is because we aren't as strong as we need to be in an ideal world. But instead of God expecting us to be perfect in an ideal world, he says, okay, so let me give you reminders. And if you have reminders, most people, if you pay attention, you just pay attention to the reminder, then that will be enough. Right? I mean, Ariely does a million different ones like this, right? He had an experiment where, you know, people were stealing money or not paying, you know, the dime for the coffee cup, right? They had a communal coffee room, you had to put in a dime, right? So people weren't putting in the dime. So they did an experiment for, they would alternate weeks. One week they would put a picture of a flower on top of the coffee machine, and one time they would put a picture of an eye, right? When there was a picture of an eye, people paid the 10 cents, right? It's not a camera, it's just a picture of an eye, right? But a picture of a flower, they wouldn't, right? People, we are so easily prone. Now, that can work against us, right? But it can also work for us. And the solution to working against us is recognizing our irrationality, right? I'm just finishing Dan Ariely's new book, right? But he said, right, you know, here, his example here, you know, in the whole book is about spending, right? He said, on the one hand, we are irrational, and therefore, right, we jump at a $60 shirt that is a $100 shirt with a 40% off and not a $60 shirt, right? Even if it's the same shirt, right, it doesn't matter. And that's why, right, JCPenney lost its CEO, right? His example is that the CEO of JCPenney, right, there was a new CEO a few years ago. They had been known for their sales, right? So basically everything was always on sale. It would always say $100, 40% off. And then he introduced what he called fair pricing, right? Which was everything would be the actual price all the time. Right, and nobody bought there because everyone wants a sale, so they ended up firing him, right? So he said, we're all irrational. But he said the solution isn't to just say we're to be rational. The answer is to recognize our rationality and both play on it, l'tov u'l'ra. So he said, on the one hand, right, yes, you know, if you have X amount of money that you want to spend on clothes per month, right? So that's how much you spend. It doesn't matter, sale, not sale. In the end of the day, it's $500 spent or not spent. But he said, on the other hand, people enjoy wine more if they have it in a glass cup sitting down in a dignified way than if they have it, you know, in a mug, rushed. It's just a reality we do because we respond to the experience. So he said, so why would you spend $60 on an expensive bottle of wine and then drink it in a plastic cup when you will actually experience it as a more expensive experience, a more high-class experience? You'll get more enjoyment if you have the $20 bottle sitting at your table in a nice glass, right? You can use it in both directions. It can lead us to spend more money than we would want, but it can also allow us to get more enjoyment out of things that are less expensive, right? Because we are irrational, but if you rationally choose how to set up situations where you will play on the emotion in a productive way, then you can help yourself. So he says, don't run away, don't try to be fully rational, you're not going to be. Right? You know, he goes through different examples, you know, like on the, you know, he said, you know, take vacation for example, right? People who wait till the last minute because you can get, you know, good deals at the last minute. So let's say a vacation will cost $10,000. You wait till the last minute, you can get it for $7,000. So on the one hand, yes, you might get the vacation, save $3,000. But if you plan it 3 months in advance and you pay $10,000, he said, you're not getting $10,000 for the vacation. You're getting $10,000 for 3 months of anticipation plus the vacation. We enjoy it more when we are building up to it. So you have to take into account, how are you emotionally, what are you paying for? Are you paying for the vacation? Are you paying for the happiness you get from the vacation? Because if it's the happiness, then booking it 3 months in advance gives you 3 months of happiness, not a week. It's just the reality. That's just how we function. And he notes that this is what God is really getting at, right? Is we are so fickle But if we try to deny it, so then we might fail. But if we embrace it and figure out how to use our emotions to our advantage, then we'll succeed. And if you look at 15, the Gemara's description of why does tzitzis work, right? Tzitzis is itself, it's not even a direct reminder. Right? Chazal go out of their way to tell you it's an indirect reminder. That Tanya, Hayri Meir Omer, Man Ishtana Tchelet, Mikol Minei Tzivonin. Why Tchelet? Why Tchelet of all colors? Mipnei, Sha Tchelet Domele Yam. The Yam Domele Rakia. V'Rakia Lekisei HaKavod. Because the Tchelet is like the sea, and the sea is like the sky, and the sky reminds you of Likisei HaKavod, Shneamar, V'tachar Reglav, Kemaaseh, Livnat HaSapir, Chetzeh, Mashamayim, L'Toar, Uktiv, Kemari, Evan, Sapir, Demut, Kisei. Right? That his feet is like the paved work of a sapphire stone, and like of the very heaven for clearness, and is written, a throne is the appearance of a sapphire stone. But you look at it, and you realize the Gemara itself doesn't think, why doesn't the Gemara just say, well, the color of the Kisei HaKavod, the color of God's throne, is Tchelet. Instead it says, well, Tchelet reminds you of the sea reminds you of the sky, and the sky reminds you of the Kisei HaKavod. Because that's how we think, right? We don't know what the Kisei HaKavod looks like, so it won't remind us. But we are associative thinkers. It's enough to tip you off to think of the water, which you'll then think of the sky, and then you'll think of heaven, and that's enough. That's all you need, right? And if you do that for yourself, right, there's, you know, people do this, you know, all the time, right? The reason that people set up, all types of, internet protections to prevent them from going to websites they don't want to go to, right? Or even not ones that prevent them, but ones that, you know, will have a pop-up, say, are you sure you want to go to this website? Because that's all it takes, right? All it takes is a reminder, and then we say, no, that's not really what I want to do, right? Or people who say, look, I don't want to waste time on Facebook during finals. So, right, there's all these people in college that the new phenomenon, right, is they give their Facebook account to a friend and they say, change my password for a week and don't give me the password for a week. Right, it's all it takes, right? We just need a little bit because, right, or a timer, right? A timer, you know, Facebook will shut off automatically after 15 minutes just because otherwise we'll forget how much time we've been there, right? We just need little reminders, little cues. We all do this. And the Torah does it. The Torah does it too. So if we now go back to this, right? So we now go back to the Torah. You look at here. Let's skip to 9 then. Rav Samet on Latur says, "What then is the significance of the root Latur? Is it identical or similar to the root Ragel?" So in Akkadian, the root taru means to wander, right? Leshotet. This, or something close to it, is indeed the intention in the Parsha of Tzitzit. You shall not wander after your hearts and after your eyes. But it seems that this root also has other more varied and more specific meanings as used in Tanakh. The Ark of God, which travels at a three-day distance from Israel to seek them out rest, and God, who goes before you on the way to seek out place for encampment, are not merely wandering. They move before Israel in order to locate the best place to encamp and rest. Thus we find that even if the significance of the word latur is related to movement, it does not refer to movement in general, but rather to an action aimed at a purpose of choosing. This command involved neither military preparation for conquest nor preparation for the division of land and settlement, but rather something quite different. The command reveals God's wish that his gift to Israel, the land which he sought out for them, which he chose for them as inheritance, should be given to them according to their mortal choice as well. Right, so we discussed this a bit by the Meraglim. So he said, but what does the word latur mean in the two different cases? Latur seems to mean something like see with the intent of choosing. And that's the word that's used in the two places, because God says, what I wanted you to do was to see the land and perceive my goodness. I wanted you to, right? I didn't want you to see the danger. I wanted you to see how good the land was and say, I want this too. But you wandered the wrong way. That's always the danger, right? When you say, go and make a purposeful choice, you can make the wrong one. You went and I sent you latur. I sent you to make the right decision. I sent you to be inspired to go and see the beautiful land and see, hey, this is what God is giving us, and realize God's behind us, and wow, there are powerful enemies, but God promised he was going to help us defeat them. I wanted you to make the choice to to see it and internalize the good thing. But the good latur turned into the bad latur. Right? Not right, make a choice, internalize the decision, but you were led astray. Right? You saw something different. You saw the danger, and that led you to a different place. You made a different choice. So God tells you, I want you latur sometimes. I want you to see and internalize and be excited and make your own choice. I just don't want you to do it in the wrong direction. So God tells you, it was a good idea, but you did it wrong. So now, I got to warn you. You do it all the time. Don't make the same type of mistake over and over that you always make. And if you look in Yechezkel, right, God makes it clear. And he says as follows. He said, he's describing the Meraglim. And he says, "Bayomahu nasati adi lahem lo tziyam mi'eretz Mitzrayim. That day I swore to take them out of Mitzrayim. Eretz asher tarti lahem. To the land which I had already, latur, I had already spied out for them. I had already seen. Zavad chalav udvash, which is flowing with milk and honey. Tzvihi l'chol aratzot, the fairest of all the lands." God says, look, right, you can be led astray. You can be caught up in emotion, but I want you to be caught up in the good emotion. I wanted you to see the beauty. That's why I sent you latur. I did send you latur. Latur doesn't have to have a negative connotation. I saw it. And when I saw it, what did I see? I didn't see what you saw. I didn't see the danger. I saw Eretz Zavat Chalav Udvash. I saw Tzvi L'chol Aratzot. I saw that it was the fairest of all lands. You didn't trust my eyes, my perception. And God said, that's always the problem. Right, and you know, just to remind ourselves, but here are the things we've seen throughout Bamidbar. This theme is over and over, where right, we pointed out that the problem, the Chovav story, was that Moshe had said, "Vayita lanu le'inayim," that Moshe wanted Chovav to be his eyes, even though he didn't need those eyes because God was leading them. In Bamidbar Yud Aleph, right, people were complaining about their perception of the man, right? Vatanav shenu yivesha in kol bilti el man einenu, right? We are upset because our souls are shriveled up because all we have to look at is the man. Va'aman kizera, God who, and it just looks like coriander. Ve'eno keina bedolach, and its color is like bedelium, right? Vayishma Moshe Am Bochem Shchotav Ish Levetachalo Vayicharaf Adonai Maod Veinei Moshe Ra. Moshe hears this, sees this, and it's in his eyes. It's bad, right? The theme throughout Bamidbar has been this: that God isn't out to get you, right? God has given you something beautiful. He gave you man. That's great. You can choose to see the good. You can look at it and see its beauty and see the amazing, and then your irrationality will work to your advantage. Your emotions will work to your advantage because you'll be caught up in God's goodness. You'll say, hey, look, God gave me man. He gave us this pure, white food which comes from heaven. He must care about us so much, right? You'll be caught up in rapture and love. But instead, you looked at it and you chose to sow white, bland food. So, it led you to despair. God says, go to Israel. I saw it. It's beautiful. Look. When you're looking, you have a choice of what to look at. Which emotion are you going to allow to overtake you? It's a choice. Yes, you're irrational. Right? Paul Bloom wrote a book which it called Against Empathy. But one of the things, it's meant to be provocative. Obviously, the front cover has a picture of a heart in a block of ice. Right? It's meant to be provocative. He's a psychologist at Yale. But one of the things he notes is it's true that human beings are irrational. But we're primarily rational because we overcome our irrationality all the time. Right? And his example is, he says, right, Dan Ariely and his school all say, we're irrational, we're irrational, we're irrational. Just give in to the fact that human beings are irrational. He says, what are you talking about, we're irrational? Yes. We all empathize and irrationally want to take away the immediate pain of our children. And therefore, when we go in to give them the vaccine and they start crying, all we want to do is pull them out of there. And yet we stay there and make sure they get the vaccine because we know rationally it's better for them long term because they will be healthy. We have the ability to overcome our irrationality. That's what it means to be human. And Dan Ariely's point, even, yes, human beings are irrational, but You can use that to your advantage. Right? See the good in something, right? If you manage to get yourself to see the good, then you'll be able to be caught up in the good and you'll enjoy it more. Right? As he said, don't discount all the ridiculous language on the bottle of wine. He said, by reading all this ridiculous language on the bottle of wine, we actually enjoy the wine more. We may have no idea what any of that means, tannins, and we may not taste the peaches or the cotton candy or whatever they say is there. But when we read the whole description, even though we make fun of it, we enjoy the wine more because we allowed ourselves to see that a lot went into it. And the second we do that, right, we enjoy it more. We got more for our money, right? We're happier people. And this is what God's really telling them. He said, look, I chose a beautiful land. If you just looked at the good, you forgot, you tried not to focus for a moment on the enemies, you would get caught up in the good emotions. You would realize that Tzvi L'chol Ratzot. And when people are convinced that something is beautiful, right, they're convinced they can do it. They can conquer, right? They can, right? As soon as you're convinced that something is worth fighting for, suddenly you have the confidence. If you perceived it the way I perceived it, you'd look and you realize God gave it to you. You trusted my perception and you looked with that, then your emotions, all your irrationalities would have led you to the right decision. You would have said, oh, God's right. You know, you would have been caught up in the excitement and you would have just gone and been able to fight. But instead, you looked for the bad. And once you looked for the bad, you allowed it to spin out of control. So God says, that's the message. Don't do that, right? Own the fact that you are irrational and you can be led astray or in the direction you want to go by the slightest things, and look to see that which will excite you in the right direction. And God said, therefore, what mitzvah can I give you that will teach you this lesson? Tzitzis, right? The message, I can give you one message. Symbolism is important. That symbols will help you do that. All it takes is a little bit of blue to remind you of heaven, and then you'll do what you already wanted to do. And that's what Ariely says, right? But you know, I think here, Dan Ariely really helps you understand what Hashem is doing by putting tzitzis here. He's saying, God said, look, I've seen how you can misuse your irrationality, but I don't want that to happen. But instead of just telling you, be rational, it doesn't work. I'm going to say, own your irrationality and use it to your advantage. Use symbols to convince yourself to do what you already wanted to do. And that's the message of tzitzis. And the truth is, that's the message of a lot of the Torah, right? Whether it be, right, mezuzah, or it be whatever it might be, right? You know, the reason, as the Chinuch says, the point of mitzvot is acharei hamasim nimshachar levavot, right? Based on what you do, your heart comes with, right? We do these symbolic acts because our heart follows. Right, we have all types of symbols, and we have all, and the mitzvot in many ways are meant to get us to a certain point because we own the fact that we are irrational, and therefore we need to have physical objects to, right, we do this, Rosh Hashanah, right, Simna Milsahi, right, all those things we put on the table and all the things we say, right, how does an eye of a sheep remind us of anything? I have no idea, right? But when we say, when we have a head there and we say, be a head and not a tail, having the head or even the fish, you know, the jellyfish head, right? It does a lot for us. And therefore, instead of Torah telling us, be rational, which never works, the Torah says, recognize you're irrational and compensate for that. Right? Be human, but push yourself in the right direction. So that, I think, is sort of a good closing place of the Meraglim, but next week we get to Korach, which is when things go even worse than they already were, right? But whatever, not much you can do.